President Bush on the hunt for oil.
You know, if there was a magic wand to wave, I'd be waving it, of course. It's, you know, I strongly believe it's in our interest that we reduce gas prices.
Reopening oil drilling in U.S. waters seems to be the latest approach to find more oil. But there's no magic to getting oil from under the ocean, just hard, expensive, and politically explosive work. There will be blood over oil. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, June 19th, and offshore drilling is suddenly at the center of the debate over energy. Also, the science of flooding. It's actually more like plumbing. A look at a doctor's most somber duties in the last moments of life. The complex standoff in Afghanistan. There's actually more than one. And learning from the British Parliament. Not good manners. Yeah. Not good manners, but a thing or two about democracy. That and all the news. President Bush heads to Cedar Rapids today to see Iowa flood damage firsthand. FEMA Representative Dick Hanji says thousands of flood victims have already received federal help.
$7.1 million has already been sent or put into the bank accounts of those people that were eligible and had registered.
Mr. Bush is asking Congress for nearly $2 billion in more federal disaster relief aid. Volunteers in Illinois and Missouri are frantically filling sandbags as they try to contain the rising Mississippi River. John McCain is also expected to tour the flood region today. Barack Obama was there earlier this week.
After months of negotiations, the White House and leading Democrats have agreed on a new war funding bill. The deal includes $162 million for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the extension of veterans' education benefits for veterans and more time for people on unemployment. Congress has bypassed a presidential veto to push through the $290 billion farm bill. Iowa Senator Tom Harkin.
It's strong for producers, strong on conservation, good for nutrition.
About two-thirds of the funding is slated for domestic nutrition programs like food stamps, with some $40 billion for farm subsidies.
A ceasefire between Israel and Hamas has begun. Egypt brokered the agreement, which is designed to halt Israeli raids into Gaza, which Hamas controls. Boeing may have yet another chance to win a $40 billion air tanker contract. Government auditors say the Air Force and the Pentagon botched the bidding for the contract and should reopen it. If successful, Boeing could regain its decades-long lock on supplying planes that can refuel other planes in midair.
Couple of finance stories. Two former Bear Stearns hedge fund managers could be indicted on securities fraud later this morning. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that they will be. Oil prices in Asia are rising on news that a militant group in Nigeria attacked a Royal Dutch Shell oil plant. Oil's up nearly $137 a barrel today. The S&P 500 opens after a drop yesterday at 1337.
And we're talking about honesty today, honesty between doctors and their terminally ill patients.
We're going to be talking to a doctor about the difficulty of dealing with patients in the last moments of life and what little clinical guidance doctors get. But we want your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Of course, you're free to respond to anything on the program as well.
And the question with the doctors is, should they tell them bluntly
right.
that they are terminally ill, or are there other ways to help people understand their predicament?
Truth, what are the consequences on The Takeaway?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Yeah, we know a place. Good morning, everybody. That's the Staple Singers, who were on top of the charts back in 1972. The month was June, and Saddam Hussein was in that place called Iraq, on top of the political pyramid there. And what he did in 1972, in June, was nationalize the oil industries, which was the last time private industry, private sector oil had access to the enormous oil reserves in Iraq. Well, 36 years later, there are four Western oil companies that maybe do have access. They're right now negotiating with the Iraqi oil ministry for no-bid contracts to serve the country's largest oil fields. It's an exclusive story in the New York Times today, and Andrew Kramer reports that story for the New York Times. Andrew, thanks for joining us. Explain which four oil companies have been picked for these no-bid contracts to service the Iraqi oil reserves. Last time I checked, there weren't just four oil companies in the world.
That's correct. The four oil companies that are at the forefront of this are ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, and Total, the French company. Now, Chevron is also in the bidding. The reason why these four companies are interesting is that they were the partners in the original Iraq Petroleum Company that held the concessions in Iraq back in 1972.
Isn't that a bizarre coincidence, Andrew? Is there a sort of a political backstory to all this that you could explain to us, or does this make total sense because these companies are the ones with the right tools and nuts and bolts to service the old tools?
Well, I don't think that there's any doubt that these companies have the right technology and tools to service Iraq's oil fields. But as you pointed out, they aren't the only companies in the world that have that technology. Why they were chosen under these no-bid contracts is a little bit of a complicated story. The Iraqi oil ministry says it's a natural outgrowth of the company's charitable work with the ministry pretty much since the invasion in 2003. These companies had been providing training and expertise to the ministry for specific fields on a free basis, essentially on a pro bono basis, and the contracts were represented as a continuation of this prior practice, but now the companies will be paid for their work.
But to suddenly go back to 1972 ignores decades of an Iraqi oil relationship with the Soviets, now the Russians. What are the consequences of that, do you think?
Well, I don't think the Russians are happy about this. The Russian company Lukoil had a very large contract with the Saddam Hussein regime. Now they've been told that that contract is not valid. Nonetheless, the company had been providing training and donating equipment such as ambulances to the Iraqi oil ministry in hopes of securing contracts under the new government. They were working on West Kurna field in the south of Iraq. Now, under the current round of contracts, Chevron and Total were offered the deal to work on that field. This is bound to upset the Russians. The announcement is not formalized yet, and the company Lukoil didn't have any comment, but I would expect there to be some reaction.
Andrew, given everything that you said and the fact that no-bid contracts are unusual, as you note in your reporting today, in the industry, explain why there isn't some concern that giving these contracts to those four Western companies really confirms the perception that many have that the U.S. only went into Iraq to control those oil resources.
Well, there may have been that concern. It's not something that was voiced by the Iraqi oil ministry or by the Americans. It may be a case of doing the right thing for the industry at the risk of having a very bad appearance of serving the Western oil interests. The American government has been advising the Iraqi oil ministry for the past few years, and it would be hard to imagine that their decisions have not been colored by that advice in choosing large Western multinational companies to work with. Another option would have been to continue the relationship with the Russians or to invite in the Chinese national oil companies. Now, neither of these would have been likely have been politically acceptable to the United States.
Thank you, Andrew. Andrew Kramer reports for the New York Times in Baghdad. And, of course, negotiations on who's going to deal with the oil in Iraq are part of a much bigger set of negotiations that's going on right now between the U.S. and Iraq.
Yeah, oil is really just the beginning. The talks between Iraqi and U.S. officials taking place in Washington this week to work out a security pact with a deadline looming at the end of the year have been going on for some time, but there's been several snags. There are many sticking points, including Iraq's insistence that they have the right to veto veto U.S. military operations on Iraq soil. Jonathan Steele, a columnist for the British newspaper The Guardian, broke this part of the story. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning.
It seems the Iraqis are really putting their foot down here. What kind of negotiating power do they really have?
Well, they have quite a bit of power, and it's also that the Iraqi parliament has power too. So it's not just the government, and the government in a way can hide behind the parliament because there's a lot of suspicion from nationalist MPs both on the Shia and the Sunni side about this continuing occupation and US having immunity for their troops' performance and so on. And so the government, even though it is under strong pressure from Washington to make a good deal from the American point of view, will always be able to say, look, there's no point in the deal you're suggesting because it'll never get through the Iraqi parliament.
Do you think Washington saw those issues as well as the issue about whether or not the bases that are currently there will be permanent? Did they see the insistence on the part of the Iraqis coming as they move toward these negotiations?
Well, I think discontent with the occupation has been rising in Iraq, impatience and so on, including among the decision-making elite, which used to be very much in favor of the occupation. There's been a sort of shift of mood, a gradual shift of mood. And, of course, the government in Baghdad is now getting increasingly close to the government in Tehran. And Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister, just a few weeks ago was in Tehran trying to assure the Iranians that Iraq would never be used by the Americans for any kind of attack. Obviously, that's very important for Iran. It was attacked by Iraq under Saddam Hussein in 1980. So it was very significant that Maliki felt he had to go to Tehran to reassure the Iranians about American intentions.
So what do you think are the critical issues as the UN mandate that's allowing U.S. troops to operate there now expires at the end of the year?
Well, I think it's highly unlikely, in fact, almost out of the question, that the U.S. would allow Iraqi courts to have jurisdiction over any potential crimes committed by Iraqi troops. The Americans have been paying for Iraqi lawyers to go to Germany, Japan, South Korea, and Turkey to look at the similar type of agreements there to explain to them that it's nowhere in the world do U.S. Troops come under foreign law. So I think that point will never be conceded by the U.S. The more important thing from the Iraqi point of view, though, I think, is the question of these bases and whether they will have the right to veto U.S. operations, because obviously one of the key aspects of sovereignty is to say we are in charge of our own security. And if some foreign troops do things without consulting the Iraqi government, then how can they claim to be sovereign?
As to the permanent bases, how is that being discussed? What is a permanent base? The U.S. says they're not building permanent bases. The Iraqis say that they are concerned that they are. So how is this being discussed?
Well, I think the very fact that the U.S. Robert Gates had to say earlier this year that we have no interest in permanent bases was a sign that they recognize this increasing nationalism on the Iraqi side. But then, of course, you get into semantics. What is a temporary base? If it's not permanent, then it's temporary. But how temporary is temporary? Is it for 5 years, 10 years, 2 years, or whatever? And the oil minister who I interviewed in London the other day, Hossein al-Sharistani, was saying that this agreement, this status of forces agreement, will last a maximum of 2 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, in theory, of course, it could be renewed, but they don't want to give any kind of green light for permanent bases or the bases even longer than 2 years.
John Steele? Thank you very much. John Steele is a columnist for the British newspaper The Guardian.
And, of course, we've been hitting over and over the question of what are U.S. long-term intentions in Iraq? What's it going to look like? And Jonathan Steele is just the latest conversation.
Well, it's a critical component of exactly what the next president's going to get and what the continued U.S. presence there is going to look like.
Well, the great irony is that there's going to be a campaign and everyone's going to be talking about Iraq. McCain and Barack Obama are going to be talking about Iraq. But meanwhile, these negotiations are going to be going on and they are the reality.
And what's interesting is the agreement has to go through the Iraqi parliament, but the Bush administration is saying it's not a treaty, so therefore Congress does not have to approve it. That's another interesting point I'm sure we'll get to.
We'll see if the Democrats have something else to say about that. But the U.S. and Iraq, one of the issues on the takeaway. And, of course, you can contact us, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. It's estimated that 1,500 people die of cancer each day. That means everywhere around the United States, around the world, really, doctors and patients and their families are dealing with the last moments of life. What are their conversations like? What choices do they make in those moments? And that's why our takeaway question today is about honesty. Do you believe that honesty is the best policy in those last moments, particularly if we're talking about doctor-patient relationships? 877-8-MY-TAKE is how to reach us. A new study by the American Society of Clinical Oncology reveals that only a third of terminally ill patients talk to their doctors about end-of-life care. We asked Dr. John Marshall, an oncologist at Georgetown University Hospital, to join us this morning to talk about this moment and the moments that he has shared with patients. Dr. Marshall, describe your toughest moment and how you dealt with it.
Well, actually, it was a few years ago, pretty early in my career, and it was one of those mistakes that will forever live with me. Part of it is being the messenger. I mean, I think a lot of times you do get shot as the messenger. In this particular case, it was a young man who started his week with just some funny feeling in his abdomen. The next day, he gets a scan. The next day, he gets a biopsy. And by the end of the week, he is showing up in my office, not really sure what to expect. And the young man said, well, Doc, is it cancer? And of course, I answered him very bluntly and very honestly, yes. And the next question was, well, Doc, am I going to die of this cancer? And unfortunately, the answer to that also was yes. And he was one of these guys who was just asking very black and white sorts of questions that in the end, the answers to them threw him into more and more of a depression. And I think of that as a mistake because I told him the truth. I told him what he was asking, but quite honestly, there was a lot more to the story than the way his questions were leading the discussion.
So you wouldn't have been dishonest in that situation if you had to do it over again, but you would have added more information and told it in a different way? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Back the guy up and say, you know what? Yeah, this is a bad disease, and yes, this probably will be the end of your life, but no, there are things that we can do to slow this down, and yes, there are going to be some good times and bad times, but this is not the immediate end of your life. He left that office thinking, just total devastation.
Dr. Marshall, how clinically prepared were you for that moment based on your long, long training?
Well, you think that you're prepared for everything you're going to see, but quite honestly, I've been at this for a while, and every morning when a clinic starts, I know there's going to be some surprise, some manhole out there that you can step into, because people are different. People bring to the clinic a different set of expectations. This is incredibly powerful information that we're handing out. This is life and death stuff, not only from the initial diagnosis of, oh, you've got cancer, to the monitoring of these patients over the years. And then the cancer comes back, and that, of course, is a very powerful, very meaningful moment and discussion. And then the one that's sort of been the more recent focus of, well, what is the end of life, and when does one stop treatment? And
Wow. Each
of those moments, and each clinic day to day carries with it a discussion, information that has to be shared that's clearly going to have not only an influence on that one patient that you're talking with, but frankly has what I like to call the ripple effect across that whole patient's world, their work, their family, and everyone else.
Dr. Marshall, do you mind if I ask you when you thought you were actually getting reasonably good at this? Was it a particular
maybe
patient?
Maybe next year someday.
Maybe next year.
You do get better at it. It is a lot of what the calling for an oncologist is. I think, people ask, why would you do that job? I wouldn't do anything else. I think these are patients that need information in an honest and caring and kind way. They need context to it. And the reason I say, you know, we're never really good at it is that any single discussion with a patient could always go on. There is always more information we could talk about. And in today's world, unfortunately, we've got to keep moving. And so, you know, there isn't really a single patient encounter that isn't cut short in some way that we could do a better job.
It's kind of like a radio show.
Yeah,
there isn't an interview that isn't cut short.
Dr. Marshall Adora Udoji here. Were you surprised by the American Society of Clinical Oncology's survey showing that a third of terminally ill patients had not had that end-of-life conversations with their physicians? And do you think that your personal commitment to this has to do with your personal experience?
Yeah, no, I'm not really surprised. I think the study, in a sense, takes a snapshot of what is a long-term relationship. A patient and their oncologist has a long-term relationship. And in fact, when an oncologist decides to have the so-called talk with a patient to say, okay, we've done all we can do, there's nothing more, that's different for different patients. There isn't a right time for a given disease or for a given patient, because we have to remember that these folks have developed certain defense mechanisms, if you will. They, you know, I think about the patient who spends their time in clinic taking notes, doesn't show much emotion in clinic, but writes it all down. Then you get the other patient who sort of jokes it all off or you know, ignores it, head in the sand sort of approach.
Well, to sum up then, in the limited time that we have, I guess it's about embracing the experience, not so much studying this moment like you would study a piece of tissue or a cell.
That's right. You're actually interfacing with a patient and trying to make the best decision on with that patient as to how to tell them the information. Some patients don't really want to be told the final information, even though I realize that the article stresses that, you know, patients do want to hear these things. Frankly, many patients, when they are told that, find a sense of hopelessness. The thought that there was some treatment out there was their defense mechanism, if you will, to keep on fighting, keep on living.
You know, I hate to do this to you, but is there a particular patient that comes to mind that you're dealing with right now who's handling a particular challenge? We just have a few seconds, but still, I just wanted to have a face in my mind before we say goodbye.
Well, it's really an everyday thing. I've got a patient who has is suffering with metastatic pancreas cancer. And
what's her name? First name?
Her name is Eileen.
Well, we wish her the very, very best. Dr. John Marshall, thank you so much for sharing your stories and your clinical insights. Dr. John Marshall is Chief of Hematology and Oncology at Georgetown University Hospital Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center in Arlington, Virginia. We've got some responses. Ed, via our website, says, I lived in Japan for 4 years, and in general, the doctors over there never tell the patient about their terminal prognosis. They lie and tell the patient that they're going to be okay. They tell the family, however, the truth and let them deal with it. I was asked about this and was told it's the most sympathetic and compassionate thing to do. Different culture, I guess, says Ed.
Just want to say, John, that was a really powerful interview you did with Dr. Marshall.
Well, Dr.
Very
Marshall,
thought-provoking.
Well, he has, you know, the experience, and that's really, you know, interesting. We're asking a question. Is honesty the best policy in the last moments of life? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses 2 boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We begin this segment with the headlines from Femi. Okay.
Thanks, John. 27 minutes to the hour. Two names to listen out for today, Ralph Cioffi and Matthew Tanning. They were former executives at Bear Stearns. They have just surrendered to New York federal authorities. They were believed to be being indicted this week. They've already surrendered. And one of the investigations that have been going on for a year have been talking about how they were responsible for the collapse of the Bear Stearns hedge fund. We will talk about that much later on in the news and also bring you more information as we get it, getting no response so far from the attorneys of either of those two former Bear Stearns executives. The US and China will launch formal talks on the bilateral investment treaty after 2 days of high-level meetings in Maryland. The US and China, which lead the world in oil imports, also agreed to a long-term plan to deepen cooperation on energy and environmental issues. South Korean President Lee Myung-bak is very sorry. He's apologized for the second time for lifting a ban on U.S. beef imports. South Koreans took to the streets for over a month over the new beef deal, which they feared could expose them to mad cow disease. And a young mum is turned into a celebrity in China. Jia Jia Jiang was buried for 50 hours in debris in last month's earthquake. The TV cameras have been following her around. She's been expecting her baby. Her little baby girl was born earlier on today, and she's been called Love out of respect and in honor of the rescuers.
That's an amazing story. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
50 hours. That is certainly a long time. Also in the news this week, Afghanistan. There have been one headline after another. The question is, the Taliban making a comeback? The number of Taliban attacks are up from this time last year, despite increases in NATO and Afghan troop levels. One of those very talked about incidents this week, Taliban fighters staging a prison raid that freed hundreds of their insurgents. And we've called Tom Gutierrez, the director for the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, to get a better understanding. Tom, is the Taliban making a comeback in Afghanistan?
Well, I think certainly in the headlines they seem to be, and the fact is this particular series of developments is as much a mirror of the kind of situation that has been going on in one way or another in Afghanistan over the last 5 years, essentially the period of time that has been consumed in their rebuilding or the reorganization, restructuring after being driven from Afghanistan after 9/11, and our own kind of focus to the west in Iraq rather than in Afghanistan, which, of course, took place in 2003. And during that whole period of time, particularly 2003 to the current time, the Taliban have been, I think, refocusing their approach, rebuilding their numbers through very effective recruiting programs, and have been coming across border. And these particular attacks, because they seem to be so bold, would suggest that the Taliban are renewed. Some people might say that this might be indeed a demonstration of the fact that they're having more difficulty in being able to be effective against the combined forces of the Afghanistan National Army and the NATO and American forces.
You mean particularly as a result of the increases that have taken place in the last year or so?
That's right. So some people suggest that, well, maybe this is a kind of a last ditch. It's not that, but at least a indication that they're trying to make some headway where they have not been before because of this increase in troops. Others feel that this is indeed an indication of the fact that the Taliban have regrouped effectively. And I think we need to understand that this is not the same.
Let me just interrupt you right there, because I think it's important to know that you have actually lived in Afghanistan for 10 years, and so are intimately familiar with the culture of the country and the history. In terms of whether or not the Taliban has made a comeback, there are some reports that say or claim that they may control as much as 30% of the country. So when we hear Hamid Karzai talking, is he only really talking from a position of controlling some certain portion of the country and not for the entire country?
Well, that is true that he only controls, and so do his allies, including us, certain parts of the country. And that part of that is due to the fact that the Afghan government and we do not have the resources, quite frankly, in terms of personnel both regarding the government itself and our own military and the international aid organizations to have an imprint in every place around the country. And so, individual groups of Taliban or neo-Taliban, as I like to call them, because they are not exactly like the Taliban that, you know, originally were in control of Afghanistan in the decade before this one.
Well, Tom, before we go, if you were to draw a map of what Karzai controls, what the Taliban controls, what other tribal groups control, would it look like, three or four big shapes inside Afghanistan, or would it look more like, somebody took a paintbrush and just kind of speckled it all over?
Well, more like the latter, and also this is very very much in flux. One couldn't just map out parts of Afghanistan and say this is always Taliban, this is always government, because there is movement of this, and the Taliban come in, and then they're forced to retreat, and the government reestablishes control, and so there's this kind of flux, and so it'd be hard to paint it in that first way in which you suggest.
All right, we have about 20 seconds or so. You just finished teaching a class for American, Canadian, and British military going to Afghanistan. What do you tell them about what they're dealing with when they get there? And we have about 20 seconds.
First thing I tell them is that there's no ambiguity. Afghans want us to be there. This is not like Iraq. And they know that their future is dependent upon our presence there. And they've always had this positive feeling.
Tom, thank you. Tom Gutierrez, the director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
Some interesting news this morning. Democrat Barack Obama says he's opting out of public campaign financing. He certainly raised an enormous amount of money on his own. Now he's going to go it alone. Also, we have a report of jobless claims. The Labor Department says that jobless claims fell by 5,000 last week to 380,000, but it's still a sign that the economy is weak. And, of course, there are the Bear Stearns executives who have surrendered in Brooklyn. They're going to be indicted later today.
And we're going to have more on that story
later.
And these are just off the presses. These are all stories that have broken in the last half hour.
Well, the Bear Stearns story is interesting to me because I want to know if there's any fraud that might have motivated the federal bailout of Bear Stearns, which is, of course, a multi-billion-dollar bailout. We don't know yet, but it's an interesting question.
And as the question you would point out is whether or not the feds knew there was a question of fraud.
When did they know it, and what did they know? Honesty on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, John. There's politics, and then there's politics, which might actually sound obvious, but it's not necessarily.
We have to talk about politics again?
We do.
Can we have some
We're going to be doing
a
little comparing. Just ride along with me for a second. In an old building in London at high noon yesterday, some men and women, they came together for a traditional weekly meeting.
This is not a treaty that Britain wanted or needed. It's a treaty he was so ashamed of that he had to sign it in a room all on his own.
That's the British Parliament, and that's David Cameron, the leader of the UK's Conservative Party. And we could call it theater, but in London, that's what they do call politics. Cameron was talking about the Lisbon Treaty relating to the European Union. He
had
some harsh words
down.
For it.
Yep.
That the Irish, they did indeed. And let's compare that to what was going on in Washington, another meeting of men and women on Capitol Hill yesterday at noon Eastern.
Madam Speaker, I rise in strong support of this bill and yield myself as much time as I may consume.
So recognized.
Ooh, that's a little more subdued, a little sleepier.
It's very polite.
Yeah.
But confrontation is a rite of passage every prime minister in Britain faces every week in the House of Commons. And they get questions and they must respond. And here's what Prime Minister Gordon Brown had to say back at his critics in the Commons.
Even now, they cannot give a straight answer on whether they support a post-ratification referendum. This is not a position of principle. It is opposition for opposition's sake. Once again.
Order. Order. Allow the Leader of the Opposition to speak.
Mr. Norris, you're far too noisy. I've said you're far too noisy.
Mr. Morris. Noisy Mr. Morris. Now, are you saying this is a better way of doing things?
No, I'm not saying it's a better way. I'm just pointing out that it's a very different way. Both of them in the U.S. and the U.K., they're dealing with very serious topics.
Sure.
Homeland Security was at noon in the U.S. yesterday, and they were talking about the fate of the EU and how it's organized in London. But they do it in a very energized way. Let's just take another listen. This is Washington, okay. Democratic Representative Benny Thompson talking about Homeland Security.
Madam Speaker, explosives remain the preferred weapons of choice for terrorists the world over. Explosives have been used against this nation abroad and on American soil.
I'm sensing a real C-SPAN moment here.
But in the UK's Parliament, David Cameron, we just got to take one listen to him again.
Frankly, I've seen more spine and leadership from a bunch of jellyfish.
Yeah.
Why doesn't the Prime Minister give some leadership, tell us what he thinks, and kill this treaty today?
Yeah.
It's kind of...
Can you imagine someone saying no comment to that?
What's interesting, though. A presumed presidential Republican nominee, John McCain, said last month that he would like to go before Congress and answer and ask questions. And we put he wants to do something like this. I don't know if that's exactly right, but we thought we'd give you a taste of perhaps of what that might sound like if you put the two together.
So
the
Washington
US
and London together.
All right.
The Office of Bombing Prevention provides the necessary analysis
yes.
and coordination of our nation's bomb prevention capability to best protect our citizens from the threat posed by explosive materials.
So it's like C-SPAN, but with spice.
With spice.
C-SPAN with spice.
Well, this is
like
what
it.
John McCain said, earlier this year, that he would be open to that.
All right. What could spice up our democracy? Call us.
Yeah! Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday and it's June 19th and we have the latest headlines from Femi Oke. Good morning, Femi.
Good morning. 12 minutes to the hour. Jobless numbers just out this morning. The number of newly laid off workers filing for unemployment benefits dropped slightly, falling by about 5,000 last week. Oil prices rose this morning in Asia on news that a militant group attacked a Nigerian oil field. Royal Dutch Shell has shut down the plant, which produces 200,000 barrels per day. Oil is up 23 cents to just over $136 a barrel on the Asia markets. Two former Bear Stearns hedge fund managers have just surrendered to face security fraud charges. Ralph Siafi and Matthew Tannin have been under investigation for misleading investors about the risky subprime mortgages. Boeing has one more chance to win a $40 billion air tanker contract after the federal government watchdog GAO said the Air Force botched the bidding for the contract and should reopen it. The Air Force awarded the contract to a European company in February, which upset some members of Congress. Republican Todd Tehart represents Kansas, the home to a Boeing plant.
What the Americans need is an American tanker made by American workers right here in America.
If successful, Boeing could regain its decades-long lock on its deal with the Air Force to supply planes that can refuel other planes in mid-air. That's a quick look at your news.
Thank you very much, Femi. Also breaking in the news just this morning is the fallout from the Bear Stearns collapse that happened earlier this year. Two former managers from the bank have surrendered to authorities and are now facing criminal charges after a year-long federal securities fraud investigation. The Wall Street Journal's reporter, Kate Kelly, joins us. She was first to break the story of the Bear Stearns hedge fund collapse last summer and has been all over this story this week. Good morning, Kate. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
What's the latest on this?
Well, the two former fund managers of these Bear Stearns hedge funds that lost investors $1.6 billion last year were arrested this morning by authorities, and they're expected to be arraigned today in a Brooklyn federal court. we expect on charges of securities fraud as well as mail and wire fraud.
What exactly are they being accused of doing?
I think the focus of the case that prosecutors want to make is dealing with disparities between sort of their private conversations about the state of the market and the funds and what they said publicly to investors. One thing which is in my article today is that there was an email sent by one of the fund managers late in April of 2007 in which he said to the other fund manager, I'm worried about the state of the CDO market. CDOs were these complex kind of mortgage-connected bonds that they invested in. I think we should consider shutting down the two funds. And this came just about 4 days before there was a conference call in which he and his business partner sort of reassured investors and said, look, we're relatively optimistic. We think that we're going to be okay. So it's things like that that I think prosecutors are going to try to exploit to say, look, these guys intentionally misled the public.
But to broadly people who follow the market, I mean, there's a chain of events here that I wonder if you could help to illuminate. I mean, these funds collapsed. Then Bear Stearns started to have problems. Then Bear Stearns started to collapse itself. Then there were these negotiations for J.P. Morgan Chase to take over Bear Stearns. Then the feds stepped in. Is it possible that all that was set in motion by a fraud case or the collapse of these funds that is now under criminal investigation?
Well, yes and no. I think that the collapse of these two hedge funds, which happened in a very public fashion last summer, was really the first shoe to drop for Bear Stearns Companies, the parent company. Not so much that it cut to Bear's core business at the time, but just that it raised questions in the public and among investors and lenders to the bank. Is this bank well run? Do they have good risk management procedures in place? And the answer felt to a lot of people like it was no. The company did okay for another few quarters. They did experience their first ever loss at the end of last year in their 84-year history at the time.
Wow.
But it wasn't until March that a run on the bank forced it essentially out of business and forced a fire sale to J.P. Morgan. Now, I don't think that was brought on by the fact that federal prosecutors were probing, but I do think there was a profound loss of confidence in Bear the company. And remarkably, what happened to the parent company in March that forced that sale was not dissimilar to what happened on a far smaller scale to these two funds.
Wow.
The funds were invested in the mortgage market, which turned out to be risky, but their more immediate problem was that their own lenders started pulling out money and saying, we don't think you're a going concern, basically.
But there's a really important point in there. Some of the tone of the reporting has suggested that these two men are responsible for taking down Bear Stearns. They're responsible for taking down possibly, or the accusation is, two funds, but not of taking down the entirety of Bear Stearns.
Right, and I think anyone who asserts that is making a way over the top assertion. I think these two guys were in the unfortunate position of being the first hedge fund managers to very publicly go out of business in a situation where they had some investments connected to the mortgage market. In that sense, the decline of their funds was the first domino to fall for Bear. So I think sort of poetically we can look at it that way. But I think in reality, their business and even the entire division they were in, Bear Stearns Asset Management, was a very small part of Bear Stearns Companies. It really had little bearing on what was happening at the parent company.
Kate, you know, congratulations on this story and being all over this. I guess
Thank
I'm
you.
Wondering, what is the exposure now? You know, J.P. Morgan Chase came in to take over Bear Stearns. As they were doing their due diligence on the takeover, is there possible exposure that J.P. Morgan has a case against the parent company because maybe they didn't know as much about the sort of criminal dimensions here as they should have?
That's an interesting point. I have not heard any talk about J.P. Morgan trying to sue what really now is sort of a shell of Bear Stearns Companies that they now own. I mean, that would almost be like suing themselves, so I can't imagine it. But J.P. Morgan definitely was cognizant of the liabilities associated with their purchase of Bear Stearns, and I think executives there would probably argue that's why the share price they paid for Bear Stearns was so low. It ended up being $10 a share for a company that was worth far more than that in the public markets just days before the sale talks went underway. But at the same time, J.P. Morgan has incurred what it estimates to be $9 billion and climbing in liabilities associated with this purchase. And that is litigation, severance pay to employees who are losing their jobs, and so on. They're also having to foot the legal bills for these two guys that were arrested today as part of a pre-existing contract that Tanin and Chiaffi, the fund managers, had with Bear Stearns. If they're found guilty, they will become responsible for those fees. But for now, J.P. Morgan's on the hook.
Kate, let's go back to John's timeline.
Sure.
The initial trigger for the federal investigation into these two men, was it the email? And is there some corroborating evidence to some of the charges that you're aware of at this point under the belt of the U.S. attorneys?
Okay, I'll take that sort of in two parts. I mean, I think the email that I wrote about today, I think that emerged during the course of the investigation. I don't know that it was the sort of prompt of the investigation. I think the Fed started looking into this last summer simply because these funds were collapsing, as I said, in a fairly public fashion, and they wondered if there was something there. Investors lost $1.6 billion. They were angry. It certainly appeared that risk management had fallen away, so I think they probably perceived that the nuts and bolts of a possibly promising case. As for the emails, I think those were uncovered during the course of investigation. And again, the email I wrote about today that talks about Tanin's doubts about the market for CDOs, which are these complex bond securities, is the sort of thing that could help them make their case. On the other hand, I must say, a lot of people have argued to me, as I've discussed this with lawyers and other hedge fund managers, this is the kind of debate you have when you're a professional
right.
investor.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm.
Well,
nobody knows where the market's going to go, and it would be silly to say that they knew
sure.
subprime
right.
was going to collapse.
Well, the great thing about this is, I mean, there could be a deal that we never get to see, but if this does go to trial, this will be an extraordinary window on the opaque world of hedge funds. Quickly, yes or no?
Absolutely. And the other significance I would share with listeners is that, you know, feds try to go with their strongest cases first.
Mm-hmm,
I mean, that seems
mm-hmm.
to be kind of the MO. So everyone should take a look at these indictments and make a judgment. Is this a strong case or a potentially weak one? Because if it seems to be the latter, that could tell us that the feds don't have a lot in their back pocket. However, if it's strong, it could be ushering in a period of pretty tough criminal charges for Wall Street and potentially mortgage company executives who had a role in investors and borrowers losing their shirts during the credit crunch.
No, that's an excellent point. We'll keep an eye open for
that's
that.
Great
again,
stuff,
thank
Kate.
You so much,
Thanks.
Kate Kelly, staff
thank
reporter
you.
For the Wall Street Journal, for joining us and illuminating
wow.
what is going on in the world
that
of hedge funds and criminal
story.
Prosecutions.
Everybody's drooling over possibly peering through that window if it does go to trial. Anyway, keep your responses coming. We're talking about honesty between doctors and their terminally ill patients, honesty in the finance markets. We're also talking about the sound of democracy in the British Parliament.
Yeah! Greg Jones here from South Dartmouth, Massachusetts. Let's remember that Robert's Rules of Order is an American invention from an Annapolis graduate, as I recall. There have been beatings, shootings, physical confrontations, and all that sort of thing in the American Senate. Daniel Webster attacked somebody with a cane, and perhaps the rather boring stateliness of the dialogue and discourse in the Senate and the House is a result of these physical confrontations that have taken place over the years.
So perhaps there's stuff. Good reasons why it's quote-unquote boring.
We're just
today.
Not mature enough to be able to do it without Robert's Rules of Order.
We'll take a look at some of that again.
Thank you very much. 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's how you reach us on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway